I wonder if, like me, you've ever avoided something like the plague. You know that common term that we have to avoid something like the plague? Whether that's the dentist, and don't like the idea of those drills and that boy footering around in my mouth, or whether it's the Black Friday sales, whenever you see the signs go up, you go the other direction because you just do not want to deal with it, or whether at this time of year, you're going into Edinburgh for something, and then you remember, oh, hold on a second, the festival's on, the buses take three times as long, the crowds are startling and you can't get anywhere. You avoid it like the plague, don't you? You just cannot be bothered getting close to it. But our aversion to these trivial sorts of things, it pales in comparison to what we're going to look at this morning. Because if you were a religious Jew in the first century, there were many things that you had to avoid and many people that you had to avoid. They were contaminating. They were defiling. They were dirty. And they were talking about us. Gentiles, non-Jews, and the areas in which we lived. And we're going to look at the first half of Mark chapter 7 together at the moment and then read the rest of the chapter later on. And as we read this, we need to keep in our minds that what Mark's talking about as the washing of hands, it's not teaching your 7-year-old son the importance of personal hygiene, because it is important, but rather these ritual washings are a religious thing. They're supposed to ensure that you, a good Jew, were not going to become defiled because you touched something when you were out working, or particularly if you were in the marketplace and you were buying and selling with folks who were perhaps Gentiles. This, to be defiled, was a costly thing. It was a time-consuming problem, and they avoided it like the plague. So let's read Mark chapter 7, and we'll read down to about verse 23 together. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were unclean, that is, unwashed. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and kettles. So the Pharisees and teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders, instead of eating their food with unclean hands?" He replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are but rules taught by men.' You have let go the commandments of God and are holding on to the traditions of men." And he said to them, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commandments of God in order to observe your own traditions. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. But you say that if a man says to his father or mother, 'Whatever help you might otherwise have received from me is Corban, that is, a gift devoted to God,' then you no longer let him do anything for his father or his mother. Thus you nullify the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down, and you do many things like that." And Jesus called the crowd to him and said, "Listen to me, everyone, and understand this. Nothing outside a man can make him unclean by going into him. Rather, it is what comes out of a man that makes him unclean." And after he left the crowd, he entered into the house, and his disciples asked him about this parable. "Are you so dull?" he asked. "Don't you see that nothing enters a man from the outside and can make him unclean? For it doesn't go into his heart, but into his stomach, and then out of his body." In saying this, Jesus declared all food clean. He went on, "What comes out of a man is what makes him unclean. For from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. They're startling words, aren't they? This morning I hope we're going to see that Jesus teaches us about defiled hearts here in this first section. And then as we go on into the second section of the chapter, we're going to see that Jesus also invades defiled spaces. So he teaches us about defiled hearts. These religious leaders, they're all flustered. They're all up in a tiz because Jesus' disciples aren't following what the Jewish religious leaders had been teaching. They hadn't followed this practice of ritual washing. It's important to note, and Mark makes a big deal of it here, that this wasn't found in the Old Testament law. This was the tradition of the elders. These are practices that had grown up within the Jewish religion over centuries. And these were passed down. They were set up as kind of a safeguard against this idea of spiritual defilement. But Jesus has no time for it, does he? Do you notice how he goes for the jugular in verses 6 to 8? He quotes God's spokesman, Isaiah, when he spoke of the people in his own time, hundreds of years before. And notice how he completely strips them of their religiosity. He says that they cared about what they said, but inwardly they didn't care at all. They just didn't care. And in verses 9 to 13, Jesus gives this example of how they continue to do this. It wasn't just about this idea of spiritual defilement. It was about how they treated people. And it was about how they wrote people off or allowed people into their group. And so they had this situation. Your adult child, when you've grown up a wee bit and your parents are maybe in the care home and they're needing a wee touch of help and maybe they're needing a wee bit of money to help them through. And you have this hideous teaching, don't you? Flies in the face of God's law. You could get out of having to help your family by giving this money to God. Or at least giving it to the temple or something like that. And it's not that the idea of giving to God is bad, is it? But they've become so misguided as they've tried to codify and legislate what God said. And the way they do it, they completely miss the point. And what happens is they have this situation where this adult child, he doesn't want to help his parents out. And so he gives the money one way instead of giving it to his parents where it should have gone. And the religious leaders, they were in on this. And they were allowing this to happen. And so Jesus turns to the crowd. And he gives them this important teaching about sin and defilement. He clears up all the misconceptions. The problem isn't about food. It isn't about what you eat. That stuff doesn't intrinsically affect how you relate to God. It isn't about what you put into your bodies that cause spiritual problems, but it's about what comes out of your body. And back then, this was radically new way of looking at the problem of sin. And even today, this is hard. This is hard for people to understand. I was talking to a chap, must have been about a year ago, and I was chatting to him on the street, hadn't met him before, and he thought that maybe I was a spiritual man, and he said, the reason you're so spiritual is because you've never had surgery, and because you've got a good diet. Now, if you look at me, you can tell that my diet's no good. And what he didn't know was a couple of years earlier I'd got my appendix whipped out of me because it was about to burst. So the man's whole idea was completely false. But he had all sorts of suggestions about certain spices and seasonings. If you eat salt from the Himalayas, if you eat cumin from this region, all these things will make you more spiritual. And that seems a bit silly to us, doesn't it? It seems a little bit unusual. But fundamentally, that's what we do as well sometimes. That's what we fundamentally believe about being a good person. Because we think it's about what we do. We think it's about who we support. It's about what we give. It's about how we follow the rules of our society. John Gemmell, who was the pastor in Bransfield a few years ago, he always had this example. If he ever wanted to paint the picture of him being a good person, he would always use this: I even recycle. That's the high point of being a good person, isn't it? I even recycle. I even bother to separate out that silly little bit of cardboard so I can stick it in the right box. We think it's about what we do. But Jesus is flipping our view of this inside out. Because it's not about what we do, but it's about who we are. And because of who we are a fundamental problem at our core. And this is where all of our other problems come from. And he gives us this list of sin at the end of our verses from 21 on. And these are hard things to deal with. And I don't think we should misunderstand Jesus here. He isn't saying that all humans go to the extremes of this list. Not everyone has murdered. Not everyone has stolen. But all of us have felt the pain of being slandered and gossiped against, haven't we? And it wasn't because someone happened to eat a dodgy steak the night before. It was because it came from their heart. And all of us have deceived other people in some way or another. Whether out of malice or in an attempt to protect ourselves. And that didn't come because I was a little bit in a rush to eat my lunch the day before and I hadn't went and washed my hands. That came from my heart. Because there's a problem there. And likewise with all of the attitudes and with all of the actions that Jesus has in this little list. Whether it's theft or whether it's arrogance, all of them spring from our hearts. And Jesus is using this here to expose our sinfulness. We were born with this heart condition of sin, weren't we? And no amount of doing can fix that problem. And if we truly believe what Jesus says here, then we have a serious problem. Because if you scan all of the philosophies and all of the religions of the world, you will quickly find that it's what you do that makes you better. Whether that's modern liberalism, where it's about what you protest or what you buy, or whether that's Hinduism and Buddhism, where you have these idols of stone that we were just getting taught about in the Amy Carmichael story. With this idea that our actions will determine how we get reincarnated or whatever it is. It's all based on our actions. And no amount of our actions can change this fundamental problem that Jesus is talking about. We have this sin problem, and any more than way back when the plague was going around Edinburgh, the people thought that they could hold the wee posies to their nose, that would keep them safe. That's what our actions are like doing. Doesn't work. But although the teaching in this section finishes at verse 23 and we quit reading at that section, we've got the remainder of the chapter to read. So let's now read that together, because I think the second half of the chapter fills in a little bit of the story as well. Verse 24, Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek. Born in Syrian Phoenicia, she begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. First, let the children eat what they want, Jesus told her, for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Yes, Lord, she replied, but even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And then he told her, "For such a reply you may go. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee into the region of Decapolis. There were some people there. Some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk. And they begged him to place his hand on the man. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven, and with a deep sigh, he said to him, "Ephphatha," which means "be opened." At this, the man's ears were opened. His tongue was loosed, and he began to speak plainly. Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone. But the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. "He has done everything well," they said. "He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." So we've seen Jesus teaching about defiled hearts. But here Jesus is venturing into non-Jewish territory. He's going into a new place. And this is the main occasion when he does so. It's the only time we have recorded in our New Testaments when Jesus travels outside of the boundaries of historic Israel. And it's an interesting little vignette of what Jesus did there. Mark's making a massive point here about how Jesus relates to people outside of the nation of Israel. And as we go through this, we're going to see that Mark emphasizes who this woman was. And Jesus is here infiltrating defiled spaces. The previous discussion about defilement, it's a setup for this section. Because when Jesus went into the area of Tyre, he was going into an area that would be off limits for a good Jew. You wouldn't be allowed to go here. To live among these Gentiles was defiling, it was dirty, it was a bad idea, just like eating with the unwashed hands. And yet here's Jesus, this man who's done incredible miracles, and he goes deep into this enemy territory, seemingly to rest with his disciples after the recent busy period of ministry. But do you notice his attempt to fly under the radar? It's absolutely scuppered. He's famous, he's popular, and so we get this one little episode of what happened while he was travelling. And we see this woman, this Gentile, and Mark underlines who she is. Did you notice? He talked about her as a Gentile, he talked about her as being born in Syrophoenicia, and he talks about her as being a Greek. Three times he's emphasising who she is. And her daughter is under some form of demonic control. She has an unclean spirit. And she begs Jesus to heal her daughter. It's interesting. Her daughter, she isn't just unwell. She doesn't just have a bit of a fever. She's got this impure spirit. And here's Jesus. He's in this unclean place. He's among unclean people. And he's being asked to heal this girl with an unclean spirit. And to a Jewish mindset, if anyone was going to catch the disease of spiritual defilement, here it is. The trio's in front of him. He's going to be infected. But it doesn't happen. And we shouldn't miss the humanity of this situation. We can talk about the theology of the impurity and all that, but can you imagine the pain of this mother? Can you imagine what she's going through? And perhaps she would have done anything to see her daughter restored to health. And she hears through the grapevine some way that Jesus has come into the region. This man who in Israel had healed hundreds, maybe thousands by this stage. And he's come into the area. They never come into this area. They've never come near us before. And so she takes her chance. And perhaps Jesus is sitting at the family meal and all his disciples are around him, and maybe the host family is sitting with him, And she comes in. And Jesus gives this very uncomfortable reply to her request. We would expect Jesus to say yes, wouldn't we? When she comes into the room and asks for a healing. But instead, he gives this very uncomfortable response. And he gives her this scenario. And I wonder if there wasn't a table sitting next to him when he was dealing with this, and if he was just using the situation at hand to illustrate the problem. You see, you have the children sitting at the table, and you have the wee dogs underneath, and they're barking and going mad as they always do. And they're sniffling around to see if there's anything for them. But sure, you don't give them the loaf before you give the child the bread, do you? That would be obscene. Of course you don't. Of course you don't feed the family pets along with the children. It's common sense that the children don't go hungry because the dogs need fed. And I think there's a point that Jesus is making here. See, he didn't come to be this travelling miracle worker. There were men at this time in history who went around and they went to all the big cities. They would have gone to Rome and to Athens, maybe to Alexandria, and they would have tried to get a big name for themselves. They would have tried to do miraculous things, maybe a little bit like our modern day magicians, David Blaine's and those sorts of boys. But Jesus didn't travel around the great cities of his day. He came with a very particular purpose. He came to the Jews. He came to Israel. And he came as their Messiah. And this woman and her child situation, they're not part and parcel of that. They're Gentiles. They're outsiders. And as harsh as this all may seem, notice the woman's response. Some people have looked at this and they've taken offense at what Jesus says. But notice, if anyone was to take offense, surely it would have been this woman who took it. And she didn't. She responded knowing that she was an outsider, knowing she had no claim on what Jesus could do. And yet she has this incredible answer to the whole scenario, doesn't she? And I just wonder, if they're all sitting at the table and Jesus posts this idea, you don't feed the children first. And if she noticed one of the wee dogs going up to one of the wee children and the child, as children so often would do if there's dogs at the table, a wee bit taken off the edge of the loaf and down and under it goes. Maybe another wee bit goes in under as well, you know. She has this incredible answer. I wonder if it happened in front of her. Maybe she just had particular wit or insight. But she realizes that all she wants from Jesus is not a loaf. It's not the stuff that needs to be used to feed the children. It's just a little thing compared to his ability. Even though it was impossible in the sphere of medicine, even though it was impossible in the sphere of these religious leaders' religion, yet it would just be a crumb of what Jesus was capable of. Just a crumb. And Jesus responds to her faith. And he heals her daughter. And this incredible miracle happens in the most hostile of areas. And presumably one of the disciples went to see how it turned out so that they could write it down afterwards. But if Mark has made such a point of telling us about the place and about the unclean spirit, I wonder what effect does this miracle have to our understanding of what Jesus was up to? And we need to think back to our problem that Jesus has just taught us about. That we are unclean from our very core. And as much as that may depress us a little and make us feel a little glum, yet it all isn't bad news, because here is one, the very same one, who shows that religion can't help. And he's showing that he is not scared of these things. He's infiltrated the unclean lands. He's dealt with these unclean people. and even has power to heal a girl from an unclean spirit. He isn't afraid of contracting this spiritual disease from these people. He's one who conquers. He's one who overcomes even our heart's deepest problems. Even though we come without any right on him, even though we come without any standing of our own to say, you must help me, even with no entitlement. And Jesus is willing to get involved in our problems, to come into our darkest situations and to heal us and to make us a part of his larger plans. And then we find the very same principle at work in the next episode that Mark presents us with. He leaves Tyre and Sidon in the north and comes back down closer to home. And he's revisiting an area that he's been in before. And this is an area that's maybe a little more mixed. It used to be part of Israel, but it isn't anymore. And here you get Jews and Gentiles all mixed up together. And although it's not stated with force, it's probable that the deaf and mute man was a Gentile as well. And he's brought to Jesus by the people of the area. They knew his power. They'd seen him at work before. And notice the faith that they have. Verse 32, they have faith that even a touch of his hand would be enough to heal this man. But Jesus takes his time with them. He deals with them individually. Remember, Jesus isn't just some miracle worker out to get another scalp. Oh, I healed 3 more folk today. Am I doing well? That's not what Jesus is up to. He isn't just a healer. He has a message to communicate even to this man before he healed him. And he communicates to this man in the only way that he can understand. He's deaf and mute. How do you communicate to a man like that? If he came in the room, how would we tell him anything of any nature? But notice what Jesus does. It sounds a little weird when it's on the page, but if you think about it, he puts his fingers into the man's ears. Oh, okay, this is to do with your hearing. And he spits and touches the tongue. It's to do with your mouth. It's to do with your speech. And then he looks to heaven, as if to say, this isn't just me, this isn't just a man, this is God at work in your life. This is Jesus acting in line with God's will. And with a sigh and with this word, this command to the body, he heals the man. And the people who saw this, they were overwhelmed by this miracle. This man, who was beyond any help, been healed. And the people of the region confess that there's something special about Jesus. Notice he's done everything well. He even makes the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. And in saying all this, they actually confirm that Jesus was the long-promised Messiah. Jesus quoted Isaiah 6 a little earlier on. Well, they're quoting Isaiah back to him. And saying that he did everything well, they probably didn't even know it. Because Isaiah spoke of a time when the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped, and then the lame will leap like the deer, and the mute tongue will shout for joy. And Mark's showing us again that these promises made to the nation of Israel have gone beyond that country's borders. And so here we are today, Gentiles at the very ends of the earth. And we aren't like children pressed with our noses against the sweetie shop window, only longing that we could get in there. We're invited to come in, and we find in Jesus this radical inclusiveness that is space for the outsider, space for the unclean, space for even the defiled. Jesus taught us about defiled hearts. He also invades defiled spaces. And as we finish here, perhaps you're aware of your own sinfulness and your brokenness. Perhaps you know that all of your attempts to justify yourself, they just don't work. And you're realizing that you need somebody to come and to deal with you, someone who isn't afraid of the issues. And here's Jesus. He doesn't run because of the depth of your problems. But he welcomes you with open arms, and with him you'll find healing. And it's not like he's surprised by what he finds in our hearts. Look at that list again that we read. He knows very well what's in us. And we will be constantly amazed by the depths of his grace if we come to him. But maybe we're here tonight, and we're here this morning, and like the Jews, we have this category of unclean people. Those folk from that estate, those Edinburgh folk, you know, dangerous to go and mix with them. Folk that you shouldn't mix with, folk who are uncomfortable to be among. And many of them live as our neighbours, and most of them haven't actually heard what the message of Jesus is all about. They've heard the name and they use it plenty, but they don't actually know that it's about grace. They still think it's about what they can do. It was fascinating working with Faith Mission for a couple of years, and we went door to door around houses. And the thing that we always came up against, "Oh, religion, we're not good enough for that." And you kind of, after a while, you stopped being flustered by that response. Of course you're not good enough for it. That's the whole point. Whatever made you think that you should be good enough for it? And here we are. And we're looking at Jesus, and he's going into these unclean lands, these Gentile spaces, and he gave us the pattern to do the same. And we see it in Acts as they spread out from Jerusalem into Judea and into the whole Roman Empire. And not very long later, they even made it to pagan Britain. And eventually they crossed Hadrian's Wall. And here we are as recipients of the gospel. And the next door neighbour that we have are the one, two or three down the street, and they don't know yet. And we have this option, this possibility that we can go and that we can share what Jesus is doing here. Not being afraid of their defilement, but going boldly, knowing that Jesus' cross is sufficient even for them, even as it was just for us.